Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Into the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, do economists know everything? Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I have had, I can't tell you how many, I'm not even going to guess how many emails since November 10th, since yesterday. Really, earlier in the day on the 9th, I guess, when this first went up on the website, Paul Krugman's piece, Franklin Delano Obama, and in which he mentions, the basic premise of it, first of all, is that FDR was not aggressive enough with the New Deal. And he quotes MIT economist E. Cary Brown saying, the fiscal stimulus was unsuccessful not because it doesn't work, because it wasn't tried. In other words, FDR wasn't enough of a Keynesian. And you could argue that in his first 2 years in office, in 33 and 34, he didn't have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, wasn't really able to get a lot done that, or all the things done that he wanted to do. Most of those things came in 1935 when he achieved a two-thirds majority in the Senate and thus a filibuster-proof majority. But anyhow, there's this one line in here that Paul Krugman drops in that says, what saved the economy and the New Deal was the enormous public works project known as World War II, which finally provided a fiscal stimulus adequate to the economy's needs. I beg to differ. I am sorry. It's Paul Krugman is a brilliant economist in many regard. He and I debated free trade on the Air America cruise a year ago, and we've done so on this program over the years. He's a free trader. I am not. And he also apparently is of the opinion that World War II got us out of the Great Depression. And I am not. And I'm going to make the case that Paul Krugman is wrong. This is such conventional wisdom, and it has been promoted, frankly, by Republicans since 1952. Well, actually, since Republicans since long before that. But the fact of the matter is that we were coming out of the Great Depression. In fact, if you go back and if you pick up a copy, and I was looking around for mine over the weekend, I couldn't find it. I've got to order another one. My dad gave me this as a gift before he died, a couple of years before he died. It's called The Illustrious Dunderheads by Rex Stout. Rex Stout, who invented Nero Wolf, the Nero Wolf character, the famous detective. Over 70 million of the Nero Wolf books were in print in the 70s. And or the 80s, whenever it was that Nero Wolf finally died. And God only knows how many there are now. And the one book, the one piece of nonfiction that Rex Stout ever wrote, he was, during World War II, he was very active. He dramatically slowed down his writing, his fiction writing, and went to work on the war propaganda board. There was some name for it that something close to that. And one of the things that he did during this time was he compiled speeches on the floor of the House and the Senate by mostly Republicans. There were a few Democrats, but it was probably 90% Republicans who were speaking out against the United States entering World War II. Most of them in the 6 months or the year leading up to Pearl Harbor, when the war in Europe was really, really nasty and there was evidence of the Holocaust happening and just, you know, the whole thing or the early stages of it. And yet these Republicans kept coming on the floor of the House and the Senate saying we shouldn't go to war. Why? Because the economy was starting to pick up steam throughout the late 30s. And they were suggesting correctly that if we went to war, it would slow down economic growth in the United States. And in fact, it did. And let me just give you the evidence of that. And I just, you know, it's I think it's so important to just push back on these myths, Because what happened was after the war, then economic growth really started at the end of World War II. And that is when the Republicans then in the late 40s or throughout the 40s and into the early 50s, Republicans started this mantra of, well, the only thing that got us out of World War II wasn't the New Deal. We need to do away with the New Deal. I mean, the New Deal is not a good thing at all. You know, we need to get rid of the New Deal, in fact. And instead, they were saying, well, you know, what got us out of the Great Depression, instead of the New Deal, was World War II. And it's just not the case. I mean, this Limbaugh even continues this mantra to this day.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
So a number of real serious scholars, as opposed to, first of all, economics is an art and not a science to a large extent. When it referred to as a science, the dismal science, you know, if you want 15 different opinions, all you have to do is solicit 15 different economists. There are very few absolutes in the world of economics, but there are some absolutes in the world of history. So let's just, you know, back this up a little bit. Joseph Cullen and Price Fishback, and there's a number of papers on this about the Great Depression. But this is just a classic article on this. The article, it's the NBER Working Paper Series. The NBER is the National Bureau of Economic Research out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. This was published in December of 2006, by the way. This is relatively recent. Cullen and Fishback. The title is, Did Big Government's Largesse Help the Locals? The Implications of World War II Spending for Local Economic Activity, 1939 to 1958. And the question that they lay out, and they lay it out, you know, pretty straightforward. They come right out and they say, you know, did World War II get us out of the Great Depression? At its peak in 1944, for example, they point out military spending accounted for over 40% of GDP. And by 1950, it was only 5%. So, gee, you'd think that that would have tremendous stimulation. Connecticut and Michigan, for example, had the greatest per capita war spending, over $10,000 per person. Didn't that stimulate the economy? No. In Connecticut and Michigan, with the greatest per capita war spending at over $10,000 per person, their growth rates in retail sales were in the lower part of the state distribution. In other words, the states that got the most World War II money actually saw the slowest economic growth. They say the natural expectation is that the introduction of World War II contracts and facility spending during World War would have led to expansions in the local economies that might have carried over after the war and led to faster growth the entire decade of the 40s. In late 1940, the unemployment rate was still hovering around 10%. So it would appear that the war helped soak up some on. Well, if you ship everybody off to war, yeah, that's going to do that. It's going to look like you have full employment. But they said an additional dollar of New Deal public works and relief spending between 33 and 39 led to an increase in retail sales, roughly 43 cents in retail sales per capita in 1939. And that can be translated into an expansion overall of 80 cents by 1939. But they point out that the war contracts had a more powerful crowding out effect than even FDR spending in terms of actually reducing consumer demand. They point out because privately owned plants that normally produce autos, clothing, and consumer goods were converted to producing military equipment. This led to sharp declines in the productions of many consumer goods and added costs of recovering from consumer to military production at the beginning of the war and then conversion back after the war. So, in fact, here's perhaps a better summary of it. They say, we examine whether local economies that were the centers of federal spending on military mobilization experienced more rapid growth in consumer economic activity than other areas. We've combined information from a wide, they look through all these 39 to 48, 39 to 54, 39 to 58, federal war spending per capita. Several factors contributed to the relative lack of impact. World War II spending often required a conversion of plants designed for civilian good production into military factories and back again over a 9-year period. Finally, less of the military spending was earmarked for wages and locally produced products. So this is World War II. Actually put the brakes on the recovery, slowed down the recovery that was seriously beginning in 37, 38, and 39. And it's such a shame that that conventional wisdom has been reinvented to a large extent to suggest otherwise. Econ Browser, The New Deal and the Great Depression. There's a very good analysis here. You know, I could get terribly wonky about this. But here's the, for example, the results from 1949 suggest that any positive effect on savings had gone away by, from World War II, had gone away by the end of the decade. 0.04 standard deviations. War spending increased bonds slightly, but that was about it. There was very little, I'm reading from the study, there's very little change in the impact of war spending on annual earnings and labor productivity within manufacturing. The one standard deviation effects are less than 0.025% in either case. Bottom line, the war did not stimulate the economy. In fact, it slowed it down. 16 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This issue has been explored recently. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Don Baudreau wrote a letter to the Wall Street Journal, to the editor of the Wall Street Journal. It's over at cafehayek.typepad.com. You can track it down. If you just plug into Google, World War II did not end the Great Depression. Just those words like that. You'll find a whole bunch of these posts and scholarly papers. I mean, there's no shortage of this stuff. Anyhow, Don, this is very, very well written. Don says to the editor, in his otherwise superb letter, Rolf Goller repeats the dubious, if common, claim that World War II got America's economy going again. And he points out the official unemployment rate actually did fall. It went from 14.6% in 1940. By the way, 14.6% in 1940, that was down from like over 30, 33, 34, 35, 36% at the depths of the Great Depression. So unemployment was coming back. Wages were coming back. So anyhow, it went from 14.6% to 1.2% in 44. But here's the problem. As Robert Hicks wrote in Higgs's book, Depression, War, and the Cold War, is the classic on this, 2006 Oxford Press, 4/10 of the total labor force, that's 40% of Americans, the 4/10 of the total labor force was not being used to produce consumer goods or capital capable of yielding consumer goods in the future. In other words, 40%, 4 out of 10 workers were making things that got blown up. It's called the broken windows theory of economics. And making things that get blown up will give an appearance of stimulus to the economy. All of a sudden, it looks like everybody's doing something. It's the same thing we saw during Vietnam. And what did that lead to? The inflation that Carter inherited. And it's the same thing that we're seeing right now with Iraq. And what's that leading to? Massive deficits, which will lead to inflation next year, the year after, 3 years after that. But it doesn't actually stimulate the economy. In fact, he points out personal consumption per capita in 45 was only a paltry 2.5% higher than it was in the still depressed year of 1940. And this is the core stuff. I mean, you just get right down to the numbers. Some of the posts over at Marginal Revolution, Don Hosek, very good one. He says, everything I've read indicates that World War II actually put the brakes on the recovery that was beginning. This is a big part of why the pro-business Republicans in Congress were opposed to entering World War II until Pearl Harbor, and some even after. And that's that book that I was sharing, that I was telling you about, by Rex Stout, called The Illustrious Dunderheads, where he collected all these speeches from these Republicans saying, you know, hey, the economy is finally starting to get back on track. Don't get into a war. He says, the worst part is that it's become common wisdom that, in general, war improves the economy when it does precisely the opposite. Just think about it for a minute. If you're building bridges and schools and roads and infrastructure, if you're even bailing out General Motors and Citibank, is that going to be a less productive use of your money than building a bomb that you're going to drop on somebody in Germany or Afghanistan and never see again? How is that bomb going to produce any kind of meaningful stimulation to the economy over the long term? Whereas the church or the hospital or the school or the any, I mean, any kind of infrastructure, anything here in the United States that will produce ongoing economic activity will. Church is probably a bad example. But anyway, here's another post. This was by Spencer. In World War II, extremely large portions of the economy were being run as a command and control economy with rationing, price controls, and virtual forced savings. Something on the order of a quarter to a third of output was essentially being produced to be destroyed in war rather than turned into consumption or investment. And Tom Kelly posts, he says, any argument that any war helps the economy is absurd, especially for young people who are forcibly handed the instruments of war and told to kill or be killed. Even for a utilitarian, the loss of their utility alone outweighs all other considerations. For a dynamist, the loss of their creativity is monumental. How many people are still dying today because of diseases whose cure creator died in the battlefields of World War II? And then the ultimate question asked by posted by John Paul over this blog, those who benefit from war are few, and those who suffer from war are many. Then you may ask, why doesn't big money invest in peace projects for the people? Isn't it true that big money would become bigger if this was done? Why isn't this done? Well, it's not done because big money doesn't become bigger when you invest in peace projects. It becomes more diffuse. What happens when you invest in the way that Franklin Roosevelt did and the way that Barack Obama is talking about doing, and this is why it's so important that we be having this conversation, because I'm telling you, this is going to be one of the things that drives the future of this economy, is this core idea of what makes an economy work. Reagan was thinking we had to have a war economy. The war was against the Soviet Union, building up the nukes and the Star Wars. That was carried on by Bush Jr., that was carried on by Clinton, and that was carried on by Bush Sr. before. And the question is now, is Barack Obama going to say, no, we don't need a war economy, we need a peace economy? What a peace economy does, when you build your domestic nation, as Alexander Hamilton suggested to Congress in 1791 in his paper on manufactures, which defined for two centuries the economic structure of this country, when you invest in and protect your domestic economies, you grow them. On the other hand, when you have an economy that is based entirely on war, and this is what Thomas Jefferson wrote about extensively after the War of 1812, when you have an economy based entirely on war, what you end up with is an economy that's essentially hemorrhaging. Which way are we going to go? 27 minutes past the end. Your call's next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Truth in Broadcasting here on the Tom Hartman Program. After 1933, this is from the Econ Browser. Actually, it's a very, very good analysis. After 1933, the economy began to grow again. This is when it bottomed out, and the real GDP increased at an average compound rate of 6.7% per year from 33 to 39. And then consumer spending collapsed. And in this landmark study done by Cullen and Fishback from the National Bureau of Economic Research, they talk about this rise and fall of World War II military spending. They say, you know, why didn't this contribute substantially to the economy? Why didn't it help the economy? Why can we see no significant economic growth? You know, war spending per capita, you know, was huge, but it didn't grow our economy. Why not? They say the sharp rise and fall in World War II military spending contributed to a substantial redistribution of the population. However, the rise in wartime military spending in a county had virtually no longer-term effect on per capita measures of economic activity, including per capita retail sales, e-bond sales, bank deposits, manufacturing annual earnings, manufacturing productivity per worker, women's share of the workforce, the share of manufacturing in the economy, housing values, or home ownership. They looked at all of these things. I mean, this is an exhausted paper. The question remains as to why the longer-term effect of spending on per capita measures is so small. And then they go through, and they go through all the very possibilities, and the conclusion, gains from obtaining war contracts at the local level were offset by similar-sized costs. Nearly all the military production directly crowded out the production of goods for private consumption and investment. Further, the transition costs from civilian production to military production before the war, and then reconversion back to civilian production following the war, likely ate into any of the benefits of war production. A war economy, as Dwight Eisenhower told us, a war economy is not a good economy. And it's just it's a lesson that we need to learn. AC in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, AC.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, how you doing, Don?
I just want to say that I never got to go to college long enough, but I'll tell you what, I live for your shows.
Well, thank you, Armin. So your thoughts on this topic here.
Okay, my thoughts on this topic is I totally agree with you, and what proves your point over Krugman, and he's in error on this subject, and you're right, is look at the facts. The facts are, since we started spending in Iraq, there's more people that are economically worse off than better. So that proves your point. And then I'd like to finish by saying this, Tom. Reason. There's a reason for everything. The ruling establishment promotes warfare economics because it maintains their power and control over the masses through emotional and economic shock and awe and indebtedness to them, the ruling establishment. So that's why they do it.
No, you're absolutely right, Armin. And this is, and James Madison laid this out, by the way. He said, no nation in perpetual war can maintain its liberty. This is what President Dwight D. Eisenhower had to say on the topic.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
And then he went on to quantify that theft from those who are hungry and who are not clothed for every warship and airplane. And keep in mind, this is the President of the United States. He's speaking to the American Society of Newspaper Editors, April 16th, 1953. He was the President of the United States. At the time he was saying this, Dwight Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander of Allied Forces in Europe. Before that.
This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children.
And what are those costs?
The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities.
30 cities. Schools in 30 cities. One bomber.
It is.
One bomber.
Two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population.
You know, how long has it been since politicians did this kind of math? One bomber costs.
It is. Two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Amen. Vern in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Vern.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Tom. The improvement is just reporting nonsense, or repeating some nonsense about the war economy. I'm looking at a Life magazine from August 21st, 1944. I was born in August 44 at Emanuel Hospital, where my mother reports there were no sheets because all the sheets had gone into the war effort.
Right.
You can see visually in the magazine that there were no consumer products available. Here's a Chrysler ad. No Chryslers.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the Chrysler was making tanks.
That's,
you know?
Right. And what they're advertising here is something called Super Finish. It was a lubricant to make parts move easier, and the ad is filled with things of people repairing roads and cleaning up airplane crashes in a war zone.
Yeah.
All the articles, I'd say 75% of this magazine is articles and ads about the war. They're personal products like hair nets and smoker's toothpaste and stuff like that, but there are no consumer products.
Right. Yep. Well said. Vern, thank you very much for that. And by the way, I didn't intend for this hour to be my trashing Paul Krugman, because I have a lot of respect for Paul. I like him as a person. I think he's a great guy. And in the realm of economics, there are far more areas where he and I agree than disagree. But there are two areas where we strongly disagree, and one has to do with trade, and the other has to do with World War II and the Great Depression. And I think I'm right. What can I say? Bernice and Dearborn. And by the way, you'll find a lot of other economists who will disagree with Paul as well for various reasons on the right and left. There is no economic consensus on this. Bernice and Dearborn. Hey, Bernice.
Oh, hi, Tom. I have two New Deal stories for you. I was number 8 of 8 kids, and there was about a 20-year spread between the youngest and the oldest. And when I was growing up, I heard about how in the early and middle 1930s, two of my brothers-in-law were helped by the New Deal. One worked for the Civilian Conservation Corps in northern Michigan, and the other one worked for the WPA, and I think that stood for the Works Projects
Works Agency, Progress Administration.
Administration, and yep. He was an agent. And they were able to be employed, and, you know, eventually they ended up working for auto companies as, you know, union members. But here they were, you know, right out of high school, and they had jobs.
Yeah, yeah. FDR put this country back on track. Thanks, Bernice. He actually did, and the economy was recovering. And it was recovering quite at a substantial rate. I mean, the average rate of recovery. I lost the piece of paper. The average rate of recovery was around 6%. It was over 6% per year over that, you know, during that period. I mean, the increase in GDP, and that's not, you know, not insubstantial. Chris in North Carolina, you want to disagree with me, Chris? Please do so. You're on the air, Chris.
Hey, I just want to disagree with your peace economy versus your war economy.
Uh-huh.
There has to be some military spending.
I agree.
You need that bomber to protect the peace economy back here in the United States. Otherwise,
Chris, how would you compare the military spending in the United States right now with for example, Russia?
And what kind of economy do they have right now? Are they building new homes? Do they have
their economy has been doing rather well for the last couple of years, although you could say that some of that has to do with the increase in the price of oil. But yeah, Russia, I've spent a fair amount of time in Russia over the last 30 years, and Russia is quite different than it was 30 years ago.
Very different.
And it's quite different from how it was just 3 years ago.
Because Ronald Reagan broke their back, though.
No, Afghanistan broke their back, if you want to know what actually broke their back, much as it has the potential to break ours. But here's my point. We are spending more on military defense than the United States. We are spending more on military defense than every other military of every other country in the world combined.
We're the biggest muscle on the block.
You know, a good chunk of that, and nobody has ever been able to really tease this number out, but the best guess is that about a third of that money is spent protecting our oil lanes. Now, do you think maybe we should say to Exxon and Chevron and all the oil companies that are importing, and even the foreign ones, you know, the Royal Dutch Shell and BP, hey, you guys, you want somebody to protect your oil lines? Hire Halliburton. Hire Blackwater. Protect your own damn oil lines. What would happen to the price?
That's protect. If we're looking out for them, it's looking out for our general economy at the same time. Now, we have our own oil reserves here that we're unable to explore and go get because people don't want to look offshore and see an oil rig.
But see, even if we pumped out all that oil, Chris, it would be a drop in the bucket compared to
consuming. I don't see a whole.
We need to shift out of an oil-based economy. We need to shift out of a military-based economy. I'm sorry, just to say that we should continue to have $1 trillion a year, somewhere between a half and $1 trillion, depending on how you calculate the military budget, an on the books $500 billion a year military budget. you know, plus another $1 trillion a year for Iraq is just nuts. And to say that that's going to help the economy, wrong.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, maybe Steve Lipsky is. This is what happens when Democrats start embracing trickle-down economics. Democratic New Jersey congressman at a game, he was in New York. Here's the story. He was at a concert in Washington, D.C. over the weekend. Some old friends see a Grateful Dead cover band. He's in the balcony, has a few beers, decides he's got to, shall we say, trickle down, and does so on the people below the balcony. They were not pleased. He went to jail. Yeah, if only trickle-down economics worked that way, you know, more commonly. Jim in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you. Let me lay out these two simple statistics everybody needs to memorize. And, you know, just very straightforward stuff. From 1933 to 1939, the GDP increased by 6.7% per year on average. From 1944, personal consumption, in other words, consumer consumption, was a full 2% lower than it was in 1940. In other words, for those four war years, personal consumption dropped by 2%. During the six pre-war years, GDP was increasing at almost 7% per year. Your turn.
Oh, I completely agree with you on not just the statistics, but the thrust of your thinking. There's an even more terrifying example for people who believe in democracy. Germany, after the First World War, they had spent 4 years fighting most of the rest of the world, and they lost all that value. You know, they lost all their gold, they lost steel, rubber, and everything that they, you know, used to blow stuff up. And the Treaty of Versailles is quite wrongly blamed for their supreme collapse of their economy. It was their war economy for 4 years.
Well, I think you could argue, and I think the argument is usually made, that the Treaty of Versailles, which mandated war reparations, in other words, they had to repay everybody for all the damage they did, bankrupted them because they didn't have anything left to repay people with. As
well,
you point
they
out,
devalued
the
their currency to
well, that's
that,
how they did
which
it, because
exacerbated their economic problems.
Right, right,
of
because the Treaty of Versailles specified that the reparations be denominated in Deutschmark. So what they did was they devalued the Deutschmark in order to be able to pay off, you know,
right,
the debts with.
And then that meant that the bushel basket was worth more than the money in the bushel basket.
That's right. That's right.
The other thing, though, the thing that really is the scary part of that in the long run is that it destroyed the Weimar Republic. It destroyed their emerging democracy.
Yep.
And, you know, I mean, my fear has always been that our military-industrial economy will end up doing the same to our own democracy.
And that was the Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, and former general from World War II. That was his fear as well, and he was quite explicit about it. He spoke about it many times, including in his farewell address in 1961, when he left office and handed it over to John Kennedy. And it's a really important point to make. Jim, thank you very much. You said it very well. Kurt in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Kurt.
Good morning. I'm not quite sure what the mystery is here. Back about 1,000 years ago, a guy named Sun Tzu wrote a book called The Art of War.
Yep.
And in that book, he was very explicit. If you go into a country and you occupy it for a long time, you're going to destroy your military, you're going to going to deplete your treasury and you're going to impoverish your people. I mean, this guy figured it out 1,000 years ago. I'm just not quite sure where the mystery's at.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward stuff. You just wonder. I mean, you look at some of the, some of the rants from Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden went off at some length about how he was going to bleed America and in Afghanistan, and bragging about it. I mean, just in the last about two years ago, I guess it was, or maybe it was 4 years ago, in his statement that was interpreted as an endorsement of Kerry, he went off about how Bush had done exactly what he wanted, and now the United States was bleeding, and we were going to be a wounded giant just like the Soviet Union was, and we were going to die in Afghanistan. And to a large extent, he was gloating because Bush did exactly what he wanted and started to squander our wealth in the Middle East. And it's just an absolute shame. You're right, Kurt. Very well said. Thank you. Sean in Indianapolis. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Sean. Good to hear your voice again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good to hear yours, too, every day.
Thank you.
Hey, I wanted to tell you, Donald Rumsfeld's coming out with a new book.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you know, the Bush administration's been very close with the Church of Reverend Sun Myung Moon.
Yes, yes.
Yes, and the book's going to be called The Dark Side of the Moonies.
Oh, jeez. Sean,
Neil Horsley is now officially in love with the Obama's new puppy.
Yes, I believe it. Thanks a lot for the call, Sean. It's good to hear from you. We'll have to play the Neil Horsley clip one of these days for our new listeners. It is great one that Alan Colmes had with these guys. Rich in Alabama, in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. You know, one of the great things about Roosevelt's leadership qualities was he wasn't afraid to ask us to sacrifice. And I hope you won't think I'm a nut job, but I'd like to run an idea by you real quick.
We got a minute.
The U.S. government spends tens of millions of dollars every year on coinage. And one of the reasons they have to do that is because we as citizens hoard them. Just about everybody has a jar on their dresser. And if we were encouraged and it was our patriotic duty to put those coins back in circulation and the average American had $10 worth, I bet you could argue that they had more, at 300 million Americans, that's about a $3 billion economic stimulus to the economy. And I want to get your thoughts on that.
It's just not much, Rich, because it goes back to being $10 per person. And, I mean, this is why, again, I hear people say, well, we need an economic stimulus package. Let's put $300 in everybody's pocket. Well, it's a nice idea if you've got a disaster. But if you really want to stimulate the economy, rather than taking a $300 billion stimulus package so everybody in America, all those taxpayers, can get $500 or $300 or whatever it works out to, instead, raise wages. Raise wages. I mean, it's really simple. It's like these idiots who call in and want to complain, for example, that the unions are killing General Motors. Not what? We're all supposed to go to Walmart wages? Is that the solution? No, it's raising wages is what drives demand. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Dr. Marjorie Cohn is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, president of the National Lawyers Guild. Her new book, Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent, with Kathleen Gilbert, will be published this winter by Polypoint Press. Her website, Marjorie, M-A-R-J-O-R-I-E, Cohn, C-O-H-N, .com. Dr. Marjorie Cohn, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Tom.
It is always great having you on. You always offer some of the most thought-provoking insights, legal, particularly constitutional insights. Two big questions that I wanted to talk with you today. The first is, how is an Obama victory a victory for human rights, both in the United States and arguably around the world?
Well, I think that first we have to look at the celebrations that erupted around the world, in Europe, Africa, the Middle East. People see this as a real turnaround in the United States government. I mean, for so long, we've really been a pariah to most people in countries around the world. When you have the Bush administration starting an illegal war, the torture, the Guantanamo, the spying, and the Obama Obama administration has the potential to actually turn a lot of this around. It's not going to happen overnight. But the United States government frequently criticizes other countries for their human rights violations, and yet the U.S. Has become one of the worst violators. And this is exemplified in the fact that we have refused to ratify three of the leading human rights treaties. Bush administration doesn't like treaties much. Bush calls them international law, and they're irrelevant to our law. But Bush evidently is not familiar with the supremacy clause of the Constitution, which says treaties shall be the supreme law of the land. So when the United States ratifies a treaty, it actually becomes part of U.S. law, and it's binding on U.S. courts. The three treaties, the three human rights treaties that we have refused to ratify are, first of all, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Secondly, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And third, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And there's also the International Criminal Court Treaty that not only have we refused to ratify, but Bush, in an unprecedented move in May of 2002, actually removed our signature from that treaty. So these are the ways that I'm advocating in a several part series of articles, starting with one that was published yesterday and the day before on my website and Truth Out and Common Dreams and other websites, called Obama Spells New Hope for Human Rights. And in the first article, I talk about why we should ratify the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights.
You know, Marjorie Cohn, I believe it was Le Monde. I was just trying to find it, but I can't. Many of us saw it. It was on one of the websites. I don't know if it was Huffington Post or Common Dreams, but they had a picture of the newspaper yesterday or the day before, with a big picture of Obama and a headline that said, you know, words to the effect of the world is changing. And I've talked before in this program, and I think you and I have discussed this, about how the United States is rare among nations in as much as we were founded on an idea rather than on genetics, on DNA. And the idea, although it was imperfectly acted out for the first couple hundred years, is getting better, you know, certainly with the Obama election every year. And you've got countries of Europe, France, a great example. They have a terrible problem with the Algerians who were given citizenship in France because Algeria had been a colony. They're dark-skinned people. They're dark Africans. And many French consider them not French because they think of France as being a country based on genetics rather than based on liberty, fraternity, and egalitarianism or something. And I think that a lot of countries around the world are having, particularly countries that call themselves democracies, as a consequence of the election of Barack Obama in the United States, are starting to reconsider their own notion of nationhood and citizenship in a way that might be very favorable and positive. We might once again be leading the world in a way, in a direction toward a more democratic, small d democratic world. What do you think?
Well, I think that certainly in one day, on November 4th of this year, the reputation of the United States did a 180-degree turn. And I'm not saying that people are unmindful of the challenges that face Obama. And frankly, he has proposed some things that that need to be challenged, such as expanding the war in Afghanistan and bombings in Pakistan, even without the consent of the Pakistani government. But you saw, for example, in Obama has said that in dealing with Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden, he wants to negotiate with Afghanistan's neighbors, including Iran. This is, I think, the best news I've heard yet, because I can see Obama actually sitting down with these people. There's been this kind of simmering cold war throughout the Bush administration where Bush and Cheney rattle the sabers against Iran, and I have been worried all along, and I know you and I have discussed this, that Bush would actually attack Iran militarily before his term is up.
Well, it's still 70 days, you know.
That's true. Now, one thing that I don't know if people are aware of, and I think it's very significant, is that Gareth Porter, who's an investigative journalist, posted a piece on JuanCole.com, and Juan Cole is an eminent professor at University of Michigan. And this investigative journalist says that the UN International Atomic Energy Agency has obtained evidence that suggests that documents that have been described as technical studies for a secret Iranian nuclear weapons-related research program may have been fabricated.
Right.
What does this remind you of?
You can find this up at the top of commondreams.org today as well.
Right. I mean, it reminds us of the fabrication of the uranium from Saddam Hussein buying uranium from Niger, which was really, you know, one of the centerpieces of Colin Powell's presentation at the Security Council, leading to the war in Iraq. And so I can see Obama taking a very positive role, and actually, you know, he's willing to sit down with these people and talk like human beings, which Bush has never been willing to do. And I think that this is really hopeful. He also has said, for example, that on one of these treaties that we haven't ratified, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, Obama described the failure to ratify that convention as embarrassing, mm-hmm. and promised to review it. One thing I do want to mention is that the National Lawyers Guild put out a press release today calling on President-elect Obama to close Guantanamo, which he is evidently seriously considering, but also opposing the establishment of national security courts. This is something that Lawrence Tribe, one of Obama's advisors, he's from Harvard Law School, has talked about, and three Obama advisors told the Associated Press that Obama is considering setting up a new court system, even though Obama said in August, it's time to better protect the American people and our values by bringing swift and sure justice to terrorists through our courts and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. National security courts would be a very bad idea. And the concerns that have been cited about why to set up these special courts that would not be like U.S. civilian courts is to protect classified information. But we have the Classified Information Procedures Act, which provides a perfectly effective way of protecting classified information, and a new report by two former federal prosecutors for Human Rights First says that they're not aware of a single terrorism case, and there have been 107 since 9/11, in which these Classified Information Procedures Acts would have failed and a serious security breach has occurred. And they say that these national security courts would give the government more power and make it easier for the government to secure convictions. So we're very hopeful in the National Lawyers Guild that President-elect Obama, when he becomes president, will not set up special courts, that he will try people, if there is probable cause to believe they've committed crimes, in the U.S. civilian and military courts, and release, repatriate, or resettle the rest of the prisoners at Guantanamo in a strict accordance with international human rights and humanitarian law and fundamental principles of justice.
Yeah, well said. We have 15 seconds, Marjorie Cohen. What do you think the chances are that that the Obama administration will prosecute criminals in the Bush administration?
Slim to none. He wants to be perceived as a uniter, not a divider, and I don't think he will do that. However, there may still be revelations of even more egregious criminal behavior that come out about Bush and Cheney, and Obama may be forced to take a closer look, but I think it's really going to redound to other countries under universal jurisdiction to prosecute people.
At least against the
well-accepted procedure.
And this is where I think that Congress really needs to be investigating, you know, Karl Rove and his buddies on down to work their way up. Anyhow, Marjorie Cohen, marjoriecohen.com, the website. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Take me away. 21 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Welcome back. And 866-303-2270, our telephone number. By the way, that article that Marjorie Cohn referenced, this is a big deal. Gareth Porter writing about this. This was originally published in Raw Story, I believe. The International Atomic Energy Agency, that's the IAEA, Mohammed El-Baradei's organization, remember when he was running around on behalf of the United Nations looking into whether Saddam Hussein had anything nuclear, and he turned and he came back and said, nope, nothing here. Bush said, well, we're going to bomb anyway. The IAEA has obtained evidence suggesting that documents, which have been described as technical studies for a secret Iranian nuclear weapons-related research program, may have been fabricated. Now, keep in mind, Iran has always and consistently denied that they are developing nuclear weapons. And the guys who have the most power in Iran are the mullahs, and the chief one, is it Sistani, I think? In any case, whoever was is the chief mullah of Iran, has actually issued a decree, a fatwa, or whatever the specific term may be around this one, saying that nuclear weapons are a sin, that this country is not going to develop nuclear weapons. So, you know, if they say they're not going to do it, if they say that it's wrong, if they say that it's a sin, the guy's in charge, and then we get this intelligence that says, no, they're doing it. And then the IAEA looks at the intelligence that we've passed along to them and says, this has been fabricated. I think we have good reason to wonder what's the deal with the Bush administration. You can get all the details at Raw Story. Gareth Porter wrote the article. Also, commondreams.org has it, rawstory.com, and juancole.com, other sites around the Internet. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Thanks, Tom. Availability of money is poor, and it's only going to be getting worse. Suggestions have been to bail out the auto industry. As they retool and make this vehicle, where is the money going to be coming from? And wouldn't it be better to put that on pause? I know the workers, if they go on strike or are laid off, they receive benefits, unemployment and benefits. Couldn't we just bring a car over from Europe, see if it will sell? If our automakers go on layoff because there's no money available to buy these cars or to save them, we don't want to be bailing them out, wouldn't it be better to invest in the unemployment insurance instead of paying them $400 every 2 weeks?
No, because unemployment insurance doesn't produce anything productive, Dave. It is an important safety net.
But if you keep
these guys making cars, or if you keep them employed, you know, retooling for cars, then you maintain a productive industry in the United States. What we're seeing is the end game here of Reaganomics. 28 years of Ronald Reagan shipping our jobs, that started with Reagan, shipping our jobs overseas, tearing down the so-called barriers that actually protected domestic industries.
But
barriers that most other countries are holding intact.
Isn't more money the corporatists starving our country even more and putting us behind the eight ball even farther?
There certainly is an element of disaster capitalism going on here. You know, Naomi Klein's take on it, particularly with the banks. The guys who screwed up are being rewarded. Yeah, I'll give you that.
So why can't we put our industry on pause until we figure it out just for a short amount of time?
That's what they're talking about doing. The way you put an industry on pause is you don't lay off everybody and let the factories go idle, because then everything starts falling apart.
Okay.
You want to put it on pause, you say, okay, we're going to cover the transition costs for the next year and a half.
But can't we make diesel turbo vehicles like in Europe and then start selling biodiesel or something like that? Why do we have to recreate it when all we got to do is reship it? Or if we're going to remake an automobile, why aren't we doing something that Europeans are getting 40, 50, 60, 70, and 80 miles on a diesel?
Right. We should be making those cars here. The primary benefit of making the car in the United States is that there are all those wages associated with it, not just the people who are working directly on the auto assembly lines, But the people who are the secondary people to the auto industry, the tool and die shops, the people who are making the electronics, the seats, the steering wheels, all that. And then even beyond that, those people who are making a good living working for General Motors or Ford, they're going home and they're going into their community and they're buying furniture for their house and they're buying groceries for their families and it just echoes out. I mean, every good job is supporting other jobs.
I would say that exactly, but the corporatists aren't going to be doing that. They're looking out for their self-interest. They have a completely different corporate tax structure that they go by. We go by a personal tax structure. They go by corporate tax structure.
Well, this is why I think if the government is going to bail these
different.
Yeah, this is why I think if the government is going to bail these organizations out, we need to do it the way that the French did Peugeot and other industries have been bailed out, the way that the Swedes bailed out their banking system, and that is you take voting shares in the company. You put members of the government, representatives of us, on the board of directors to make sure that we don't see what's actually going on right now, which is the banks are using our bailout money, not just AIG having another great little retreat, but they're actually using it for more billion-dollar bonuses for their senior executives. So it just doesn't happen. I mean, there's ways to make that work. The Bush administration just doesn't want to do it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
866-303-2270. Well, the all-time strangest alert, the one-eyed defense. Yes, a woman in Sweden busted for driving while drunk. Her defense in court, by the way, her blood alcohol level 10 times the legal limit. Her defense in court, she had been keeping one eye closed so she wouldn't have double vision as she was driving. Court didn't buy it. It's a fine thing. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jason in Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Tom. I was just curious about the Employee Free Choice Act that basically denies a secret ballot to employees when a union comes around. And I was wondering
Let me rephrase that, if I may, Justin. What the Employee Free Choice Act does is the same thing that in the 49 states outside of North Dakota that require you to register to vote, to publicly declare that you're registering to vote, and to publicly declare what party you want to be affiliated with. If when you are initially essentially registering to have a union, you publicly declare that. After that, there's all kinds of private ballots. In fact, the union doesn't even come into being until its union bylaws are voted on, its union officers are voted on. All of that is secret ballot. So what we're talking about here is voter registration. And if you're opposed to public voter registration, you need to take it up with 49 secretaries of state as well.
Well, I take issue with the way you've characterized it, because when you go and register to, get your voter registration, you're not necessarily announcing it to the world. It's in a
you
county
certainly
clerk's
are.
Office.
It's a public document. You can look up my voter registration and see what party I'm registered as. In fact, the both parties do that regularly. That's how they call people. That's how they do their robocalls.
Yeah, but you're also basing it on the idea that a business is equal to a democracy or a republic, and it's
no,
it's
I'm saying
not.
A union is equal to a democracy. A business is equal to a kingdom. Businesses are essentially set up as kingdoms. The very, very similar model, economic model to a kingdom. A union is set up as a democracy. And so if you're going to have a democracy and you want to have people participate in that democracy, it seems like a good idea to have them register to be participants. Now, after they've registered publicly as participants, then everything they do, they can conduct, all their ballots can be in secret. And in fact, they are. All union votes are in secret after the initial registration. That's what the Employee Free Choice Act specifies.
So why do we need to go from having a secret registration, as you might put it, to one that is not secret? if you acknowledge that a business is not the same as a democracy, you know, why do we need to change that system?
Because a business is not the same as a democracy. The only democracy in a business is the union. The essential issue, I think, Jason, that you're getting at here is the question of whether or not, and this is a question that has been battled in the United States since before the Civil War. Abe Lincoln was the first president to discuss this in public, is the question of whether or not labor should have rights in the marketplace as opposed to simply capital having rights in the marketplace. In other words, should all the powers of the marketplace, should all the rights, literally rights in the marketplace, be in the hands of only those who own businesses? Or should there be some rights in the marketplace enforceable by government in the hands of the workers? Excuse me. And without a union or without strong labor rights laws, workers don't have rights. I mean, you go back to the 1880s where you had Pinkerton, you know, beating people up and shooting people.
Well, I will readily admit that the unions have done some good over the decades, but since things like the 40-hour work week, time and a half, various employees...
Vacation time, health insurance...
Well, those have been passed into federal law, so...
Right, but they all began with unions.
Yes, and back then, yeah, they did a good job. But now, I just don't see the point of doing this outside of swelling the coffers of the unions and increasing their power.
Well, the unions are not... I mean, they're independent organizations, but they're swelling their coffers. It's not like, you know, if you increase the revenue of a corporation, then the stockholders end up with that money in their pocket. If you increase the revenue of a union, then that union has money for a strike fund that it can give back to its members. But that's pretty much it. I mean, nobody's getting rich off running a union. So this whole thing of swelling the coffers of a union, I mean, you know, we can talk about the coffers of a corporation because that money actually, you know, people actually get to lay their grubby hands on that. But again, the question is, and it sounds like you're of the opinion that labor should not have rights in the workplace, and I'm of the opinion that labor should have rights in the workplace. I think that the reason why we create an economy, and let's be very clear and honest and understand this, Jason, an economy is created by government. The rules of the game of business are created by government. When I create a corporation, as I have many times in my life, as I have seven times in my life, every corporation I created was created by government. I went to the government. I said, I want a whole set of tax breaks. I want a whole set of special rules and regulations. I want to be able to deduct from my income things like meals and telephone calls and employees and all kinds of stuff. I want all these cool things. And in exchange for that, I will conduct myself according to the rules of business. And in the meantime, in the context of the rules of business, I'm going to try and make some money. And it's like, you know, playing a football game with actual rules and referees. You know, it seems like a reasonable thing to do. And what you're suggesting is that the point that I'm making is that the reason why we allow people to run businesses, the reason why we encourage people to run businesses, the reason why we give them all these incentives is because we ultimately believe that people running businesses in a particular way is going to be good for society. And people running businesses in other ways may be destructive to society. Look at right now in China with the melamine getting in all the food supply and killing people. That's running businesses in a way that's not good for society. So if we agree that the reason why we have business and the reason that we have an economy, the reason that we organize government in a way to produce an economy is because that is going to benefit we the people, then we the people should have some say in that and should have some say in the workplace. And the only way that we the people can have a say in the workplace is to have democracy in the workplace, and that's called a union.
Well, I'd have to disagree with the premise. I think you have in a state like Texas, which is right to work, and many other right to work states, right, every employee has immediate democracy. If you don't like the company, if you don't like what they're paying you, you go someplace else. I mean, it's a two-way street. The business...
Well, that's the case in a union shop as well. Being a member of a union doesn't mean you can't quit your job and go someplace else.
Well, but if they go on strike, you know, there's a lot of... I think there would be a lot of coercion and fear if you try and break that strike line.
Right. The strike is where the, you know, a company saying to employees, if you guys unionize, we're going to shut down and move to Mexico. is the exact same thing as the employee saying to the company, if you won't pay us an extra 50 cents an hour, we're going to shut this business down, and you know, you're not going to make anything here. It's the exact same thing. It's power on both sides. And when you have power on both sides of the equation, I mean, I hear these Republicans going on and on about how we need to have balanced government. We need to have Republicans and Democrats. They love balance, except when it comes to the workplace. In the workplace, they don't want balance. They want all the power to be held in the hands of the managers, of the owners, and none of the power held in the hands of labor. And what if you look at history, what you see is that when that happens, you end up with terrible abuses of labor.
Well, again, I don't think that's the case now that we have those laws like the 40-hour work week that were pioneered by the unions.
But those laws are being eroded constantly right now by the same people who are opposed to unions.
Like who?
Like the Bush administration. You know, they've been rolling back workplace safety requirements, for example. There's a whole series of them that they've undone. OSHA has been, you know, OSHA is one, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, one of the major places where the Bush administration has been going after rules and regulations that keep workers safe. They're going after the Labor Department. Ever since Reagan, the Labor Department, with a brief interlude of a few years of the Clinton administration, the Labor Department has been basically anti-labor. It's basically been the let's screw Labor Department. And these are not good things, in my opinion. They don't support the idea that the reason why we have the economy is to provide for the public good, not just so a small number of people can get real rich off the labor of other people. Jason, we have to keep in mind, as Abe Lincoln said, you don't have anything until somebody makes something. Labor is what produces capital. Anybody who's got a lot of money got that money because at some point somebody worked. Labor is where it all begins.
Yes, well, the labor of the employees is where you get that return. I mean, if I
that's where the profit is made.
Yeah, and that's where the employee makes a profit. But I work, and I'm not in a union, so I don't have to pay the union dues. I don't have to go.
Right, but the employee, you're not making a profit. You're making a wage. That's a very different thing.
Well, the company makes a profit because I'm helping them and they pay me a wage.
That's right. They're paying you a wage that's less than the amount of money that you're producing for the company. And that differential is used to maintain the company. And if it's a substantial enough one, the company makes a profit. And, you know, that's a desirable thing from the point of view of a company. Until it becomes until a profit becomes more important than what's happening to the people in the community. And when you get people who are being poisoned in communities, like having the Love Canal, or like what happened to my father, you know, working in a steel mill in 1951, when they knew that asbestos caused cancer, and he was working in a cloud of asbestos, and it ultimately killed him. He died of mesothelioma as a result of that. For 30 years, those companies have been covering up what they knew about that asbestos. The asbestos that killed my dad. For 30 years, they've been covering that up. It was first reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association in the early 1930s or late 1920s. And you know, it's just so wrong. Labor should have a say in these things.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. I'm surprised we haven't heard from the Talk Radio News Service yet. It must be slow going in the news business. By the way, Michelle Malkin pointed out back when John Edwards was the spotlight of the National Enquirer pointing on him that the National Enquirer has only once been successfully sued, and that was by Carol Burnett back 2-3 decades ago. And that they do check their facts, and they do generally get their information straight. And here the National Enquirer has been reporting, oddly enough, that, you know, that on the one hand, we had I'm sorry, the mice, rats. Oh, Okay, I thought that was Talk Radio News calling, and I was just going to try and catch the call. Anyhow, they are reporting now that Cindy McCain is having an affair, and before this they were reporting that Governor Palin had had an affair with her husband's business partner, and there's a deafening silence about this on the right, it seems. But anyhow, strange stuff going on, very strange stuff going on. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Ryan in Seattle. Hey, Ryan, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great.
Hey, I really wanted to say that I appreciate your voice on the radio. I think you have the smartest voice on the radio, so appreciate
that.
Thank you, man. Hey, I did want to provide a little bit of discourse in terms of the whole auto industry thing.
Mm-hmm.
I totally believe in the United States workforce and definitely keeping, you know, our big three operating. But at the same time, I really feel like they're going down or they're not doing well because they're not competitive. They don't put out the best product. I mean, I know that there's some good cars and trucks out there, but, you know, I feel like they don't have the best product. They're behind the times. And, I mean, companies like Toyota and Nissan, that's the reason they're doing so well, generally speaking, because they have been with the times and they put out a quality product. I mean, they went ahead and put out the Prius, which I'm actually driving right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I just wanted to kind of get your perspective on that and see where that standpoint comes into your mind.
Well, here's this Ha Jun Chang points this out in his brilliant book, Bad Samaritans. Let me just tell you a quick story here. 1933, there was an Asian clothing company, and they decided they wanted to branch out into making cars. They had everything going against them, right? Their nation had no domestic auto industry. The company had no experience with the product. The United States and Great Britain in 1933 were already major car manufacturers, in fact, dominated the worldwide market for cars. But this company was able to get the Ministry of Trade in their country to say, yeah, okay, we'll help you out. Government subsidies helped the company develop their first car. Okay, I mean, literally, the first car was developed with government subsidies. They, for 60 years, the country maintained high domestic content laws that ensured that the company used parts made within the company and also guaranteed that their competitors would also have to use stuff made within the country so that it wouldn't bleed outside the country, okay, from tires to plastic components, precision machine tools, electronics. In 1939, this country even kicked both General Motors and Ford out of the country.
Yeah.
Said, you cannot sell cars inside this country. Okay, that company was known as the Toyota, T-O-Y-O-D-A, Automatic Loom Company. They
yeah.
made looms to make cloth out of silk, which at that time was the major product, the major manufactured product in Japan was silk in 1933.
Right.
And that Toyota Automatic Loom Company is now known as Toyota, which makes the car that you drive, the Prius. That car and the Lexus that Tom Friedman mistakenly thought was successful because the world is flat, those cars only exist because of government subsidies, government tariffs, and government support for both R&D and manufacture. And if we think that we're going to be able to say, oh, let's have a libertarian economy inside the United States when the rest of the world is playing chess and we're just going to play checkers, that we're going
right.
to say, oh, you know, our car companies, yeah, they can compete against anybody, but everybody else has got government subsidies, they've got import tariffs, they've got export subsidies. We're crazy.
So I guess my question is, when did our government either make the decision or turn the path to where they're turning away from American companies? I mean, what's wrong with actually taking sort of an introspective look and saying, hey, maybe we should, lay off the foreign subsidies and look at our own companies and subsidize them? Because, you know, I really doubt that all these three companies don't have a bunch of, like, research and development. I mean, they're working hard, but at the
right,
same
people
time...
Could, they, we could do it here in the United States. And you're right, we are subsidizing foreign car manufacturers. When Toyota and other companies want to build factories in the United States, we say, oh, sure, we'll give you free land, we'll give you tax breaks, we'll give you all kinds of stuff. Just give us jobs, please. We are becoming a third world nation. And,
right.
and it is because of this ideology that really started in the last years of the Carter administration, you know, Milton Friedman and now Tom Friedman being the champions of this stuff, that became an article of faith during the Reagan administration that we should simply tear down all the so-called barriers to trade. The only people that this benefits are the multinational corporations. Any corporation that doesn't give a damn what country it operates in, those corporations benefit from so-called free trade. But the individual countries get screwed and individuals in the countries get screwed. And that's why,
well,
And I think also, too, I think it just boils down to everything that's been going on in the last 8 years is just, you know, what happened to thinking for ourselves in terms of what happened to thinking about the United States first instead of the United States last?
And it's not the last 8 years. It's the last 28 years.
Right.
Because this literally started in 1981.
I'm not trying to be nationalistic about it, but I'm just saying that, like,
hey,
you know,
Brian,
we've
there's nothing
make...
wrong with being nationalistic about it. This is our country. Let's put our country first. I'm all in favor of that. And I think every other country in the world should be doing the exact same thing. And most of them, by the way, are, until they need money and the IMF comes along and says, oh, you've got to, you know, privatize Social Security, Chile. And so all of a sudden you got the international bankers making out like bandits, and the average citizen in Chile is screwed.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that's, again, ideology. That's Milton Friedman. That's the Chicago School. The Chicago School guys have done so much damage to this country, to our country, to other countries all around the world, and they're continuing to. They did the same thing in Russia. You know, when the Soviet Union fell, they came into Russia and said, "Oh, we're going to do shock therapy," and, you know, literally produced death and destruction. Yes, it is. You know, there's a lot to be said for a transition to a market economy. Notice I didn't use the word free, to a market economy. And there's a lot to be said for capitalism. Notice I didn't say laissez-faire. But do it right. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, you know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes what you think you do know, as the Fire Sign Theater says, is
wrong. You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync, and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible everything we know about milk is wrong? He says as he's drinking his hemp milk here. Dr. Sam Simon is online with us. He's an orthopedic surgeon turned dairy farmer. He's president of the board of directors of Hudson Valley Fresh. HudsonValleyFresh.com is their website, which is a dairy cooperative in New York State. Hey, Sam, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Or Dr. Simon, I guess, is
whatever
the title you have earned.
No problem.
So, first of all, milk in general. Why is milk political and why is milk expensive?
Well, I can't tell you why milk is political because I try to avoid that arena. Mm. But milk is probably one of the cheapest, most nutritious item on the shelf. But the pricing on the shelf is totally controlled by the supermarkets and the third parties. And the price of the farmer is controlled by the commodity exchange in Chicago. And there's a big difference in what the farmer gets and what's on the shelf. I can assure you of that.
Oh,
that's why Hudson Valley Fresh was created.
Yeah, to try and balance that out.
To give a fair, sustainable price to the dairy farmer.
Right.
All milk's not created equal, and these Hudson Valley Fresh represents 7 family farms, about 4,000 open acres in Dutchess County, New York,
mm-hmm.
who do not use any artificial RBST to stimulate the cows for production.
Mm-hmm.
However, have an extremely low bacteria count and extremely low white count, which is a reflection of the cleanliness of the farm, as well as the health of the animals.
Right, which raises the issue or the question, you know, how much, I guess this is, let's call it what it is, pus, right? The stuff that's in milk,
white
pus
cells,
and blood.
White cells is what, you get a white cell count of 1,000,000, you got pus, right?
Yeah, so
right?
How much of that is in milk?
Well, you don't want to have it, and, you know, most, there are regulations, and we are a country of regulations, which is wonderful. But the standard is 750,000 white count is the upper limit. And
wait a minute, 750,000, what is that, cells per?
750,000 white cells per milliliter.
Per milliliter?
Right.
That's like per teaspoon?
Well, less than that, yeah.
750,000?
White count in the raw milk, that's correct. That's the standard. That's the acceptable.
750,000 cells of pus in a less than a teaspoon of milk
cells,
is acceptable.
White cells, somatic cells.
Right, somatic cells. But, you know, I doctors call them somatic cells. I call them pus. I don't have the MD after my name. I don't have to be quite as. But I mean, yeah, you get enough of those so-called somatic cells in one place, and that's what even a doctor would look at and say, hey, that's pus, right?
Well, if it's too many of them, that's correct. And our issue was, that affects the shelf life of milk. And the lower the count, the longer the shelf life. And they know as long, if the count is below 400,000, then you can get at least a week's shelf life on processed milk.
Right.
Processed milk has a very, very low somatic cell count.
Right. So you guys are making milk that has a very, very, very low
somatic cell count. Right. It ranges between 60 and 160,000.
Right. Now, one of the concerns, I read this article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, was it last weekend or the weekend before, about melamine in China and how they were literally all over the country, dairy farmers, people who were making milk products were cutting their milk with melamine. It was sold to them as protein powder.
Right.
They had no idea that the stuff was deadly. There have been tens of thousands of deaths across China as a consequence of this. And now products made with Chinese milk are showing up in the United States. This AP story, a popular brand of Chinese milk candy has been found to be tainted with the toxin melamine. Mm-hmm. The same chemical was found in infant formula that has affected over 50,000 children across China with kidney problems.
Right.
13,000 babies remain hospitalized. This is the same stuff that, again, melamine from China showed up in our cat food and dog food about a year ago, year and a half ago.
Right.
It was killing animals.
Right.
What's the deal? How do we regulate milk in the United States? How do we make sure that
you will not see that in the United States milk, because we're a country of rules and regulations that are very tight and controls, you know, and testing, because every tank of milk that leaves this farm, it's tested, every tank.
Mm-hmm.
So China speaks for itself. These things, these issues, which you saw last year and this year, speaks about the laxity of their oversight. And one can make their own decision about what you purchase that has a China label on it. And because it's a country without rules and regulations, they're trying to jump in the 21st century.
Right, but here we have, for example, Cadbury has announced that its Chinese-made chocolate has been found tainted with melamine.
Right.
I mean,
we may not
import Chinese milk into the United States, but we certainly appear to be importing products made from Chinese milk into the United States.
Yeah, but if we destroy the dairy industry in the United States, we will be importing, looking for outside sources of that as well. That's
right.
The problem. So we need to preserve the dairy farmers of this country, the open space of this country at the same time, because those are the people who work the land.
Amen.
And you don't have to worry about buying stuff from across the ocean.
Amen. So let's very quickly talk about the cooperative. You're with Hudson Valley Fresh.
The marketing cooperative. We really merged. I negotiated with our larger co-op. We sell to a co-op called Agamark, all our milk.
Mm.
And that owns Cabot Cheese, which is well known in the country. It's a premium quality Cabot Cheese, and we own that company.
Mm.
However, our price at the farm is dictated by the order or the price of cheese in Chicago.
Mm.
However, unfortunately, this price is not a price that's sustainable for the dairy farmer in this area.
Right.
So I said, we have premium quality milk. Let's segregate that out and bottle it separately. And we've had to find a plant small enough that we could invest in to the tune of $100,000 to $150,000 through my own money and plus some grants, that we could literally not commingle our milk with anybody else's to bottle and sell
and
at Hudson Valley Fresh label.
Yeah. Well, it's great that you're doing it. And, Dr. Simon, thanks for dropping by today.
All right. Well, thank you for calling.
Great talking with you. 12 minutes past the Sam Simon, his website is HudsonValleyFresh.com if you want more information on that. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Andrew in Hallandale Beach, Florida. Hey, Andrew, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to call in about that caller that you had a few minutes ago. You were talking about unions and worker rights and going on strike and so forth. You know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. We always talk about what the Bush administration has done with regulations and with the military and with contractors and with worker rights. But I don't hear anybody talking about what I'm always wondering, and this is probably something that you could address, and that is I'm always thinking when I hear people like that, or when you interview that guy from the Ayn Rand Institute, what happened to these people in their childhoods that gave them their perspective, where they have such an authoritarian mind complex?
Well, there's two things here. There's really two things here, Andrew. I don't think that necessarily either the Ayn Rand folks or the caller earlier were expressing some authoritarian worldview. What they were expressing was the opinion that is put out by
by think tanks that are funded with hundreds of millions of dollars of money representing vast wealth in the United States. The Heritage Foundation, you know, founded by SCAIF and by Coors, the Cato Institute, which promotes libertarian thinking. You've got a whole bunch of these right-wing think tanks that were founded in the 1970s, by and large, in order to push back against the ideas of the New Deal, in order to push back against the ideas of American small-d democracy, and try to make America, you know, safer for the plutocrats and the billionaires. And
well,
somehow the average guy has adopted the billionaire worldview.
I fully agree with that, but there needs to be a concerted effort to let people who believe that they think like conservatives know that there are these think tanks out there, because it really annoys me when I see a report, for example, on Fox News that has speakers from the Heritage Foundation or from, you know, AEI or other conservative think tanks giving opinions on Obama's tax plans for small businesses that make over $250,000 a year, for example. And the audiences, many of them do not understand that you have to take the opinions from these particular think tanks or individuals representing them with a grain of salt, unless it's counterbalanced from other kinds of more academic or liberal think tanks.
Yeah.
And I think much of the audience does not understand that there has been this concerted effort with billions of dollars, especially from what are called the Four Sisters, you know, these billionaire families that have funded since the 1970s this conservative line of thought that has, you know, created an echo.
No, it has driven itself.
Media.
It has driven itself deep into our culture, Andrew, to the point where you have Democrats talking, using the phrase burden along with the word tax, which was one of, you know, Frank Luntz's early victories, and where you've got people talking, I mean, reciting, Democrats reciting this mantra that if you increase taxes, you're going to slow down the economy. And when actual factual data proves that it's actually the opposite, it's actually the absolute opposite. I'll give you the details of that. There's actually a really good op-ed on that right now. I'll share that with you at the bottom of the hour. Stick around, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Well, when I was in Minneapolis for the RNC, I personally saw, you know, the cops beat up a kid. Apparently, it's been happening all over the United States, and around political activity. Here in Baltimore, for example, this story, Jeffrey Anderson writing. 2 days after a historic election prompted spontaneous celebrations around the country, it also prompted 15 arrests in Charles Village. Local college students and professors remain outraged by what they claim was excessive force by the Baltimore Police Department. Among those arrested at the corner of 33rd and St. Paul Streets at approximately 2 a.m. on November 5th, just hours after the nation's first black president was elected, were two John Hopkins University professors, a Baltimore City school teacher, a freelance journalist, and a number of Goucher College and John Hopkins students. And one of those folks, actually a freelance journalist who worked as an election judge on election day, Michael M. Hughes. MichaelMHughes.com is his website. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
What happened?
It really started as such an incredible day. I mean, it was an election judge, at which I have been for about 5 years now. And, I'd never seen anything like it. The way people were turning out, the stories I was hearing, a woman flew in from Sudan to vote in my precinct.
Wow.
Where she could have, you know, sent in an absentee ballot. She wanted to be part of what was happening that day. And my day was full of stories like that. I mean, it was phenomenal. I've never seen anything like it, and I don't think I'm going to see anything like it. So that night I was with some friends, and we watched the election coverage and the results rolling in. And then after Obama's acceptance speech, we heard just kind of spontaneous, you know, people out in the streets honking horns and cheering. And I live in near Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, so it was a, you know, it's a lot of students, and you know, it really just, I mean, you could just hear something happening in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So with about six or eight or so of my friends, we just went out to see what was going on, and we noticed a very large crowd near the university. And at the time, I was wearing an Obama T-shirt. It was like a bootleg sort of T-shirt that I picked up in Baltimore. It had a huge image of his face on the front of the shirt, kind of over the top, really. And as I approached the crowd, they saw the shirt and just started cheering. And, you know, it's one of those things where you really had to be there. And I guess probably a lot of people listening to the show saw similar things, you know, in their cities or towns. The contagious joy, you know, was just spilling out of the crowd. I mean, people, strangers were coming up and hugging me, and, you know, people were high-fiving each other, and, you know.
So how did this segue to you being on the ground with, you know, with a couple of cops over you?
I'm sorry, I'm having just a little bit of a hard time hearing you, Tom.
How did this segue to you being arrested?
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. I mean, you know, at first the cops were very friendly and were getting their pictures taken with, you know, with people, and all of a sudden I noticed, like, they had blocked off a street to kind of, you know, keep things under control, I guess. They had all their cruisers parked at the end of the street.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I saw, like, kind of a phalanx of police officers gathering. And that's when I started to think, oh, no. And I saw them kind of group together and start marching down the street. You know, at no time was there anyone on the bullhorn or anything giving instructions to the crowd. They just kind of marched down the street and started fanning out. And at that point, my brother came running up to me and said, they just tasered some guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought, you know, what's happening here? I mean, it was just such a dramatic, you know, instantaneous change from this euphoria to this kind of fear. And I'm a journalist. I write for the city paper in Baltimore and other publications. So I, you know, I was kind of thinking, well, I gotta make sure I see what's happening here. So at one point, I saw the police bringing these people handcuffed up the street. So I got on the sidewalk and tried to stay out of the way because I didn't want to hinder anything or get myself in trouble for, you know, being in the way. And I started taking pictures with my cell phone. And when one of the officers saw me, he stepped up to me and stepped in front of me, and I held my phone out to the side, kind of just put my hands up and said, I'm a journalist, I'm just taking photos. And he slapped my cell phone out of my hand to the street, grabbed me by my shirt and said, well, write a nice long story about this, and spun me around. And at that point, I was cuffed by another officer and put in the paddy wagon. So that's how it all began.
We have about a half a minute left. We're talking with Michael Hughes, michaelmhughes.com, the website. Michael, what should people do about this? What are you doing about this?
Well, what I'm doing, I encourage people to call the Baltimore mayor's office, because ultimately I think the mayor is responsible for her police force. And you know, it was just such a horrible thing to have such a wonderful day, a day that I'll probably never see the likes of again, turn into, you know, a night in
Did you recover your cell phone and your photos?
Yeah, I did recover it, and I do have photos.
Do you have this stuff on your website at michaelmhughes.com?
Yeah, and also citypaper.com. They've been doing a really good job of covering the aftermath and the incident itself.
Great. People can check it out. Citypaper.com and michaelmhughes.com. Michael, good luck.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on and sharing your story with us. 27 minutes past the hour. Well, your phone call's up next, 866-303-2270. TomHartmann.com for our live free chat room.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 866-303-2270.
I'm small and the world is big, but I'm not afraid of anything. How does it
34 minutes past the hour. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you, and our conservative alert for the day, Saxby Chambliss, down in Georgia. The guy who ran the ads that showed Bin Laden's face and Max Cleland's face. Max Cleland, the guy who lost three limbs in Vietnam, by way of implying 6 years ago in the election that, in my humble opinion, Saxby Chambliss stole, that on voting machines that had absolutely no paper trail whatsoever and that showed a result completely inconsistent with the exit polls and the post-election polls. Saxby Chambliss running these god-awful ads, defending them recently and saying that, well, the reason why he didn't get over 50%, the reason he's going to have to do a redo, a remake of the election here against Jim Martin, is because our folks didn't get out to vote. Our folks being the white people. Yeah, that's what, well, he says, and I quote, he says, there was a high percentage of minority vote. Mm-hmm. But we weren't able to get enough of our folks out on Election Day. Saxby Chambliss, our pathetic conservative of the day. 35 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And Mike in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi. a lot of good points were made today. I think that as far as bailouts are concerned, before any money goes to any auto industry, first they got to start making products that sell. Stop making those that don't sell. You know, you take your top three producers, and the rest you go to hybrid or electric or the better fuel efficiency. You show us a model of your new business organization that, you know, can operate in the reality that exists, particularly with an energy policy, and they really can't do anything until that is something that is taken care of. And I mean, you can go about.
We have a chicken and egg problem, Mike. The problem is that without changing the rules of trade that we have in the United States, which is not going to be done by the Bush administration, and may not be done by the Obama administration, depending on who ends up, you know, prevailing in his Council of Economic Advisors and whatnot. Without changing the rules of trade, we're going to continue to have many of, if not most of, our industries at peril. But we no longer have a clothing industry in the United States because we changed our rules of trade.
You also mentioned that, you know, Lincoln said, you know, you got to produce a product first, but if you
That's
just
right.
produce products that no one buys, you still have nothing.
Well, then you go out of business.
You have surpluses of labor. And what we're seeing right now is at the end of the topping out of the Reagan philosophy is they are virtually churning the insurance company, churning insurance industry, churning the banking industry, churning home mortgage, churning industry itself.
Yep. And skimming off the top. You're absolutely right. But see, here's the deal. If we had a trade policy in the United States and a domestic production policy that was designed to bring back our computer manufacturing industry. We don't make computers here anymore. Bring back our radio manufacturing industry. We don't make radios here anymore. We invented the transistor. We don't make transistor radios. Bring back our television manufacturing industry. We don't make televisions here anymore.
But
bring back our, I mean, you know, fill in the blank, right?
But, yeah,
our
but
auto industry. Let me just finish this thought. Bring back or solidify the auto industry. Then you could say, and I would agree with you, let them fail. Let them shatter into 1,000 pieces, because what's going to happen is 1,000 entrepreneurs. You know, I would be inclined, if I wasn't doing talk radio, to go out there and find, you know, get some venture capital together and say, okay, I'm going to be the next Horace Dodge and start a small car company and you know, start it from the ground. I mean, there would be no shortage of entrepreneurs and venture capital.
You could bet as soon as these companies fall, there are going to be other companies that are going to step right in and take.
That's my point. That's my point. Here's the problem, though. Under the current rules of trade, those companies that step in are going to be companies based in China, Japan, and Germany.
No, Schwarzenegger brought one back here, Tesla Auto, back to California. We want you here. We know the reality of what is going on.
Right. He did it by changing the rules of trade. He was offering tax breaks and incentives.
That's
in other words,
right.
He basically changed the playing field. The Bush administration is not going to change the playing field. And so over the short term, we've got 68 days, 8 hours, 52 minutes, and 11 seconds. Over the short term, we're looking at over the next 2 months, you know, GM stock could literally go to zero. Over the next couple of months, we're seeing, you know, these companies could completely fail, and once they fail and they're really shattered, there's no recovering from it. And so
that you're getting this from people who sat on their hands during the California rolling blackout, who sat on their hands during the skyrocketing of gas prices, health care. These are the same people.
That's right. That's right. You're talking about the Bush administration. And that's why I'm saying, because the Bush administration is so wedded to this so-called free market ideology, these concepts that you know, just
hey, whatever happens, happens on an international basis. To hell with the United States. They don't even blink when Halliburton reincorporates in Dubai and moves its headquarters offshore to a company, to a country, rather, where you only have to keep business records for 1 year, and takes, when KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, reincorporated in the Cayman Islands back 5 years ago, so that all of the profit from the Iraq war, would they'd have to pay zero taxes on. These guys didn't even blink. They're not going to change these things. So what I'm saying is, go ahead with a bailout of GM and Ford and Chrysler if necessary over the next 65 days, just because the Bush administration will not do anything except make the situation worse. And then, once the Obama administration comes in, we need to either hold these companies accountable in a very serious way and help them, you know, reinvent themselves in a positive way, or even better, let's reinvent the rules of trade so that American companies can actually compete, even if they're competing with American companies.
I think you're right. I would rather us get there the easy way rather than the hard way, and they've chosen the hard way, and it's jungle law.
Yeah, but see, the easy way or the straightforward way or the way that makes sense is not going to happen under the current administration. It's not going to happen under the current Congress. It's not going to happen with the Republicans being able to filibuster the Senate. It just isn't going to happen in the next, you know, 80 or 90 days altogether. I mean, it's not just 68 days. It's not the moment that Obama gets sworn into office. And that's and even then, we're not exactly sure how he's going to handle it.
Just closing, I think that one way or the other, as you were talking about the commons model, we're going to get there. I would just rather see us get there with a little less pain for everyone. You know, we're out here eating squirrels, and they're up there in caviar land.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, well said. Thanks a lot, Mike, for the call. I appreciate it. There's a bunch of you on hold, but I promised this information. I just want to share this very quickly. Larry Beinhart wrote this brilliant piece. You can see it over at alternet.com, and it's called Tax Cuts, the BS and the Facts. And this is the stuff. I have been preaching this on this radio show for the better part of six. Well, we're in our sixth year. And I wrote about this in my book, Screwed. And this is one of the best summaries I have ever seen. He did in three pages what it took me a whole chapter to do. The realities, the brute facts are these, Larry Beinhart writes. First of all, he has this quote from George W. Bush, right? He says, yes, tax cuts allow people to keep more of their own money. Therefore, they have more to invest and spend in the economy, and they have more money to start businesses and create jobs. That's from Yahoo Answers, actually, that right-wing crapola. But here's what George W. Bush says. He says, I think when people take a look back at this moment in our economic history, they'll recognize tax cuts work. They've made a difference. Well, here's the reality, the brute facts. Large income tax cuts are always followed by a bubble and then a crash. One. Two, high income taxes correlate with economic growth. In other words, as income taxes go up, economic growth goes up. Income tax increases are followed by economic growth. Moderate income tax cuts are followed by a flat economy. All this is especially true as applied to the top tax rates. Okay? And here's the examples. The three great tax cuts that we've had since the beginning of the 20th century. In the last 100 years. Herbert Hoover. During World War I, the top marginal tax rate went up to 73%. In 1922, Republicans took control of the House and Senate and the presidency, and they began cutting taxes. They cut the tax rates down to 56%, then down to 46%. Then in 1925, they cut taxes, income taxes, down to 25%. You know, below 30%, just like Reagan did, below 30%. The stock market took off. There was a boom, but the boom was a bubble. It was followed by the great crash of 1929, bank failures and the Great Depression. Then came Reagan. From Roosevelt's second term all the way through Jimmy Carter, 1936 to 1982, the top rate was in the 70 to 92% range. Then came Reagan in 81. In 82, he cut that to 50%. The economy immediately went into the worst recession since the Great Depression. Why? Because Reagan cut taxes. His supporters argued it was all Carter's fault and that the new policies would take time to work. The tax cuts stayed in place. By 1987, there was another round of tax cuts. They took the top rate down to 38.5%. They said it would stimulate the economy, right? Sorry, there was a boom, but it was a bubble. And in October of 87, by the end of that year, there was another crash, the worst since 1929. We still call it Black Monday. Much of the bubble money had gone into real estate. Suddenly there were bank failures, more than during the Great Depression. Savings and loan crisis. We had to have a bailout. That's what happened during the Reagan years in the 80s. Now comes George W. Bush II. He comes in with the healthiest, most powerful economy in American history, immediately cuts taxes, top marginal rate down from 39 to 35%, also cuts capital gains taxes, cuts inheritance taxes. What happens? An immediate recession. But he persists. But the economy doesn't grow much. I mean, it's essentially flat. And then there's a crash and bank failures and a bailout. On the other hand, every time taxes have been raised, whether it was World War II, 41 to 45, tax rates was 88 to 94%. What happened? The economy boomed. Under Truman and Eisenhower, the tax rate up to 92%. The economy boomed. Clinton raised taxes. The economy boomed. Roosevelt raised taxes. The economy grew. Tax increases are followed by economic growth. Three of the four high growth periods in the last 100 years have immediately followed significant tax hikes. And the fourth, in the Truman Eisenhower years, began with a top tax rate of 91%. They didn't need a tax hike. Look it up.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Cause when I was a child, with my heart in my hand, I pledged my allegiance to the flag of this land, where Kennedy was killed in a Texas cow town, and we learned how to hide it from the bomb underground. So when the things that you tell me don't match what you do, I'd be a fool not to have a huge problem with you. And I'll still stand and fight for this land of the free. First we'll take back the ground that we lost in D.C. So stand and let your voice be heard. Stand and let your voice be heard. Stand up, speak out. This is still our country, so stand.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, a fascinating article in today's Financial Times. I just want to mention this in passing about phishing. P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G. This is like, you know, the internet fraud thing where you get an email that says your account has been closed at your bank. Please click on this link. It is, the article says, this is a trend change from global to targeted. There are all these new kinds of phishing. On October 16, for example, Message Lab, online security firm, intercepted 7,000 phishing attacks purported to be from Bank of America. It went up to 15,000 the next day, 125,000 by the end of the week, and that's only 16% of the estimated 780,000 emails, phishing emails. They're doing this thing called spear phishing and whale phishing. The chief executive of one of the biggest banks in the U.S., they don't name the guy or the bank, got one of these things. And it was forwarded to the legal department. 15 different people clicked on a link in this phishing email because they actually thought it was a legitimate email to the CEO. Unknown to the recipients, Rob Minto writes in the Financial Times today, unknown to the recipients, opening the attached document in the email installed a keystroke logger, a program that records all the activity on a computer entered on the keyboard and sends it to a remote location where the attackers can analyze it, pulling out passwords and other details. Another one hit Dave DeWalt, the chief executive of McAfee, the antivirus company. He said, and I'm quoting him, it was from my bank. They knew I was out of the country. They knew where I was. And it said my account had been suspended. It had some of my account information in it and asked me to re-authenticate myself. This was a highly sophisticated attack on me, and they may have called my office to find out where I was. Now, he had the common sense to say, wait a minute, even though this looks legitimate, I'm not going to click on this link. But a lot of people don't. Boy, be careful out there. David in Connecticut. Hey, David, thanks for waiting on hold so long. What's up?
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
No, I'm really toward the end of the time, but I was thinking back to something you said very early in the show when you told that short little story about the fellow on the balcony.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of something I've been saying for years, that all you need to know about trickle-down economics is that the people at the bottom are called peons.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Trickle-down economics produces nothing more than a nation of peons. Absolutely
exactly.
Right, David. Thank you very much. A good one. Jerry in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Jerry.
Hi. It's been fascinating listening to your story, your program, your morning, Tom.
Thank you.
I probably am going to change my what I was calling in for. One, thank you for all your talk about the trade and the balance of payment deficits.
Sure. Your point, Jerry.
It's in 94, we ran my wife for Congress based upon the fact that we were going to drive our country into the poorhouse because of the NAFTA and GATT.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I called originally was that I was wondering about your difference between Paul Krugman and how he stated his position on war and the Great Unraveling. Didn't seem very much. It seemed like your information about the consumer spending in 44 was suppressed. That spending would have been suppressed due to the lack of consumer goods.
It was.
And I was wondering if the if there was a splurge in spending when the consumer goods came back, would offset the support of the difference between you and Paul.
Yeah, there was to some extent, and that accounted for a certain post-war bounce, and also you had all these GIs coming back. But I would say that the post-war bounce, I mean, just looking at the life of my parents, you know, because my dad was in the occupation forces in Japan after World War II and came back in, I think, 40, well, maybe 19, either 49 or 50. And it must have been 49 because they were married in early 1950. There was a bounce. B, he was able to buy a home ultimately with the VA. He was able, or the veterans, the GI Bill. He was able to go to college on the GI Bill. These were programs that were basically government programs, government stimulus programs that had there not been a war would have probably found another form, but would have been there, I believe, in any case. Because Roosevelt and ultimately Truman in this case got it that this is how you stimulate the economy. And then let's not forget that starting in 52 or 53, we had a pretty serious recession. I mean, there was an economic slowdown there for a short while that, you know, it's just you have these business cycles. You know, business goes up and it goes down, broadly speaking. But to say that the war is what got us out of the Great Depression, I think, is just plain old wrong. If anything, the war, in fact, I would argue that the recession of the early 50s probably was the result of the war having depleted so much of our stockpile of strategic goods. You know, it used up so much of our steel. It used up so much of our, you know, just right across the board, our raw materials and things. We dumped that stuff on Germany and Japan.
So. Yeah. Krugman was just saying that the war gave Roosevelt the excuse to increase spending, and that's what got us out of the depression, the increase.
Well, I didn't see Krugman use those phrases. He just called it the ultimate stimulus. But I haven't, you know, I had him on about the Great Unraveling. I haven't read the entire book, but it was certainly a huge spending program, the war. But it wasn't the kind of spending program that stimulates an economy any more than Vietnam was a spending program that helped the U.S. economy. It led to inflation. And similarly, Iraq is going to lead to inflation. It's going to be a mess. So, anyhow, coming up tomorrow, consumer rights attorney and licensed mortgage broker Alan Jablonski is going to be with us, successfully navigating the mortgage maze. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. The whole thing, it all starts with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.